We appreciate the presence of each one today, this last Sunday of May. Good to have our visitors with us, and want you to come back and see us again soon. We appreciate the songs. I was wanting Kevin to lead the song, Where Could I Go But To the Lord, and it's not in our songbook. I think I've looked for it before, never could find it, and he can't find it this morning. But the lesson is entitled, Where Could I Go? And so that's why I wanted the song sung. I grew up with that song. Many of you perhaps did as well. It just makes the point, of course, that there comes a time when nothing around you, including your friends, can satisfy what you need. And when that time is there, what are you going to do? And where can you go? What I want to do in the lesson this morning is to sort of identify some ways in which the world tries to cope as it does not have the Lord. It does not have God. It does not have the gospel. It does not have the precious and exceeding great promises of God to lean on. It does not have the hope that sustains the faithful Christian every day. What does the world do? In fact, we've heard it commented. You probably have. I have, when somebody goes through some crisis and he says, I don't know how the world handles this. And really, we think about that. How in the world do people that know not God and obey not the gospel of Christ, how do they cope? How do they get by? Well, they try various things. And I want to identify some of those things this morning, and in each one of these, I guess you could say, there's a certain appeal, a certain delight, maybe an enamorment. You just really get caught up in it, and you really start using it as a substitute of the things that matter most, because it's what you want. You've sold yourself out. You sold yourself short. And you're living in a world that's not correctly ordered. Your priorities are not straight. You're not seeking the kingdom of God first, but you're trying to be a success on the earth. How does that work? How does that work? First point is, and I think a lot of people lean on this quite heavily, it's in the support of their friends. It's in the support of people that are close to them, that they like to be around and they associate with, and they exchange ideas and thoughts, and they're together a lot perhaps. And we've all thought about friendship, and Solomon gives us certain insights into friends, you know, and he will say the rich hath many friends. But he will also say that there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. And so there's a value to friendship, but what if your friends don't know God? What if they're not concerned about spiritual things? But you delight in their presence. You delight in their consolation, their comfort. And a lot of people, that's what they console themselves with. When their kinfolk die and their friends come in to help them, those friends may not be Christians. They may not be concerned about ultimate things at all, but they're their friends. And so they can cry together. They can weep together for a little while. They can try to console each other and come up with words and expressions and comments that seem to give some sort of perpetual consolation. You know, they may borrow words from Scripture or concepts, and they'll say something like, well, John, don't worry about this. You know, she's in a better place. Whether it's true or false, it has impact. Because it's the thing at that time that they, whether they believe in it or not, they want it to be so. She's in a better place. He's in a better place. And so the world, and the religious world, they'll use things like that. Well, he's gone home to be with the Lord. So it's beyond all of this. And so they borrow certain concepts and truths, and whether they have a right to or not, they apply them to a certain person. or a situation or a condition. But remember this, John 15:14, Jesus said, "Ye are my friends if ye do the things that I command you." Now we're going to have to choose our friends. Don't choose bad ones. Don't choose friends that take you down, that give you misguidance and encouragement to live in sin. James 4, James will talk about the friendship of the world. And there he's been talking about, you know, murder and adultery. He's talking about sin, like John does in 1 John 2:15-17. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, vainglory of life. He says that's all that's in the world. So James says, if you love the world, he that maketh himself a friend of the world maketh himself an enemy of God. James 4:4. So you have to choose your friends. And we can't be friends with Jesus unless we love Him, unless we obey Him, unless we keep His commandments. Number two, sometimes, and I can see how this works to a degree, people choose to deal with their sins and their guilt by a change of atmosphere. You know, sometimes, and some of you people are fixing to do this, you're fixing to take a trip to Alaska. I've taken trips to various places. Sometimes when I was younger, I can't tell you how much I looked forward to a vacation. When I was in my 20s and a full-time preacher, and I'm telling you, I love to preach, but I didn't know how to study so much. And it was pure agony sometimes. And having to come up with two sermons every 7 days was a monumental test. I can't tell you how much I look forward to a two-week vacation, getting away. We refresh our spirits by a change of atmosphere. That's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But you remember in Acts chapter 12, after Herod had killed some of the soldiers that lost the prisoners, lost Peter. At any rate, he changes atmosphere. He goes somewhere else. Luke doesn't get into the psychology of his departure, but it makes you wonder. After he took the lives of these men, and they had done nothing wrong, and as far as we know, they were faithful in their service, but he holds them guilty, and he takes their lives. And then he leaves, goes to another place. It seems to me like it's very, very possible, among other things, he wants a change of atmosphere to get away from this whole incident, and if he can, to run away from any uneasiness of conscience that may linger in his spirit. What I say about the world is, it's not just merely taking a vacation to refresh your spirit, which is fine. But sometimes I think the world tries to deal with its guilt by changing location, changing atmosphere, going somewhere else, and trying as best you can to forget about the sins you committed over here. But it can't be successful because they carry the accumulation of their sins with them. It's like they want a fresh start, but they don't have the wherewithal to have it. They would like a fresh mood and spirit. They would like to go forward again in some sort of a peace, but they don't have the wherewithal to get it. Now, a change of spiritual atmosphere, oh, that's a different thing. That's a different thing. But I'm talking about just changing geographical location, not dealing with your sin, but hoping that I can get a fresh start. You know, we hear in the movies on television about people coming west. A lot of people came to the west running away from crimes, running away from misconduct. Somebody might say, as he talks to his cowboy friend, "Well, everybody out here is riding with a secret." Well, there probably was a lot of that in a lot of cases. Even one or two prominent Texans that had some problems back east of Texas, and they got away from it to come out here and became famous and prominent heroes in Texas history. You can't run and hide from sin by changing location on the earth. It takes a lot more than that. But I can see how the world might attempt that if that's all you have. Number three, the world sometimes takes satisfaction in its own spiritual condition by relying on the concept, I'm like most everybody else. Most everybody else and I are in the same boat. If I'm a goner, they're a goner. What does God expect of us? What does He want us to do? And instead of reading it and learning it and believing it and obeying it, you just go off into ever land, some sort of a mythical domain, and just make up stuff. Well, if I'm lost, almost the whole world is lost. Well, is that any consolation? Are you going to be delighted in hell because almost everybody's there? Do you laugh and joke and have a fine time and smile and have merriment in hell because most of the people are there? The good book doesn't tell the story that way. It doesn't describe it like that. Why would you do that on the earth? If it is true that few people are saved, few people are going to heaven compared to the other place, why would you rest your case? Well, I'm in the majority. We've talked about it so many times. Romans 8:27. If the children of Israel, Isaiah said, be as the sand of the sea, it is the remnant who shall be saved. In Matthew 7, Jesus said, few are they that faint. Few people. And so we tell ourselves, we try to bolster our hearts, encourage our spirits to realize, I'm always going to be a part of the few. And yet there are people evidently that get their delight. He's a man of the world. Why, yes, he goes here and he goes there. And he just has people, friends and connections everywhere. And he's just a man of the world. And what does that do when it comes to death? And really, what did it do with you even in life? Remember in Exodus 23 and verse 2, God had that principle and that obligation in the law of Moses, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. We talked about riots and mobs and the psychology of how that works. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. So don't rest your case when you get to judgment. Well, Lord, don't hold me guilty for this. I was just following along with everybody else I knew. Majority doesn't help. Majority doesn't help in a situation like that arises. When you die, will you find consolation in a group? If you've seen somebody die, I think you would know the answer to that. Do you find consolation in a group? Or would you find some sort of a consoling peace because of truth? You know, you might not even recognize your friends when you die. You may be off in a coma. You may be in all Alzheimer's. You may not even recognize the majority or your friends or anybody else. But if you die with truth, the truth that saves your spirit, that truth can carry you, or Jesus with that truth, Jesus who is the truth, can carry your spirit to a safe shore in the bosom of Abraham. You don't want to trust in all the people. And then in the next place, number four, there are people that they think, even if they don't work things out philosophically, even if they don't work things out theologically, the best you can do is try to get yourself in some sort of a strategic position on the earth. Maybe it's political power. Maybe it's some sort of a social influence. We've got people now in our society that are referred to as influencers in social media. We've come to a point like that now. We've got a new application of a good old word, influence. And an influencer. And these are social influencers. I guess people come to their websites by the thousands and read what they're saying or thinking or posting. Social influencers. Well, maybe I want to be can I be satisfied with myself, my spirit, just by having influence and imposing my spirit or my will? Maybe it's political power. There are a lot of people that love that. We see that in our society as well. You recall in John 19:11 when Jesus was on trial for his life. And he got to the point where Pilate would ask him a question and he wouldn't answer. You know, that could make a man pretty mad. A man of authority and power had Rome behind him. And then here's a prisoner and he won't talk to me. You know, you could take that as insult and disrespect. Jesus just knew it had gotten to the point where it does no good. It does no good. And so he finally said, "Don't you know that I have power to kill you, to take your life, or to release you?" And Jesus said, he finally spoke up right here at that juncture, "Thou wouldest have no power, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that hath delivered me unto thee is guilty of greater sin." I know you have delegated authority from Rome. That's only possible because of my Father. I am the Son of the One that makes it possible to you to have power. Now, by the way, as I've said before, that word there, it's not dunamis. It's not like the power of energy and force. It's exousia. It's the power of influence and authority. It's authority. What Jesus is saying is, you wouldn't have any authority if it weren't for the Father. And in Romans 13, verses 1 and 2, you remember he said, there is no power but of God. It's exousia. There is no authority but of God. God is the basis of authority. God is the one that has delegated authority. All rightful authority goes back to God. That's what the Scriptures say. All rightful authority. Not the usurpation of authority. Not somebody who grabs it and has no right to it. But all rightful authority is of God. My life is not satisfied just because I control a country. I control a region, a continent. Maybe if I'm an emperor, I control an empire. What would it have been like to be Nebuchadnezzar, someone like that? What would it be like to be Alexander the Great? What would it be like to be a person like that, that imposes his will on so many people? Is that life? No. It may be a lot of history, but it does not satisfy the purpose of my spirit. And I know that. And if people are a little bit reflective, they know it too. Number 5, sometimes people do the best they can without God, without truth, by trying to console themselves with their possessions. Remember Jesus said, a man's life consists not in the number of things that he possesses. Now he told us the truth about that. We don't always necessarily want to believe that. Oh, the Lord wasn't serious about that. He was just giving an off-the-cuff remark. No, it's really profound. And a man can waste his life that doesn't believe it. That Jesus told the truth. My life is not my possessions. If I just have a few possessions, that's all they are. If I've got quite a few, that's all they are. If I've got a host, that's all they are. Things that I possess. And the Bible teaches I cannot leave this life with one of them. Isn't that incredible? I can't leave for heaven or hell with one possession from the earth. And imagine having spent 70 years, 80 years, 90 years trying to accumulate just to have things to look at and to enjoy and buy and all. That's my life. And Jesus said, I told you the truth. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Luke 9:62. Well, Solomon said, "The rich man's wealth is his strong city, and as a high wall in his own conceit." How does a man that knows not God, living a misguided life, look at his money? It's my protection. It's my protection. It's like a city. It's my city. And these are my walls. And I keep me and my family protected by all that I own. And you can't. You just can't. You remember in Ecclesiastes 5:19, Solomon does say in the midst of his discussion of wealth, if God gives you wealth, and He has made us wealthy, but if He does give you wealth, and He gives you the privilege of enjoying it, he said, this is the gift of God. Isn't that an incredible thing to say? He says, you don't despise that, and you don't distort it by saying, well, you know, I'm supposed to think about heaven. Yes, you are. Seek the kingdom and His righteousness first. But you're here now. You've got to get through this life now. And if you are so fortunate that God gave you a lot of things, and He gave you the privilege of enjoying them, it's God's gift to you, he said. It's the gift of God. Even though a man's life consists not of the things that he possesses, because if you've got your mind on God. Now, he gives us a warning to the sinful wealthy in Psalm 49. Oh, it's tremendous. Do you really think you can keep your brother from death by your money? You can't. You think money can do some things it can't do. It may be a walled city to you. It may be a lot of power to you. And in a sense and to a degree it can be. But it can only go so far. And its time runs out. And if you think about it, even while you're alive and you've got somebody, your brother, that's facing death, you can't save him with your money. It doesn't work like that. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. But then the psalmist says, but God will redeem my soul. He's not talking about the wicked wealth anymore. He's talking about himself. God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. None of us to give in to the temptation of taking our minds off of God and righteousness in the kingdom and just focusing on money, because money's going to run out one of these days. And then there are those that perhaps they think that if I could just get famous, that'll satisfy me. By the way, every now and then, you know, we'll hear about a celebrity that takes his life. Every now and then that comes up. And we think about, my goodness, he was so famous, and he had so much money, and we puzzle over it. We think about people that we have seen. We've seen them a lot on television. We've laughed at them or listened to their songs or whatever. And then, because we're not in their lives and in their private thoughts and in their misery, all of a sudden one day the newscast says that so-and-so died, and it has been decided that it was suicide. And we said, I can think about that. Goodness. Life is not celebrity. It's not fame. It's not everybody knowing my name. It's just not. That kind of a thought is hollow. It's hollow. Famous and celebrities don't work. Remember in 2 Timothy 1:15 through 18, Paul said, all Asia turned away from me. You know, I mentioned in Bible class this morning, Paul was perhaps the greatest Christian that's ever lived. Some would sing in that way, and I guess I'd be in that camp. I don't find one greater. Maybe the greatest Christian ever. And you think about all the people that he saw and met and talked to and prayed for and worked with and thought a lot of, and now he's in Rome. And he says, no one took my part, the first defense, second Timothy 4. And then, but back in the first chapter, he says, when Onesiphorus was with me, I was in Rome, he came to Rome for some reason, and said, when he was there, he sought me diligently and he found me. He didn't quit till he found Paul. And Paul said, Lord, grant mercy unto Onesiphorus and his family. And Timothy, you know other things he's done in the past, helpful too. But my goodness, all Asia turned away. All the people that he'd known, all Asia forsook me. Onesiphorus, what a Christian. What a delight Paul had in him. He was not ashamed. That may indicate some of the problems with some of the people in Asia regarding Paul. He was not ashamed of my chain. The Lord grant mercy unto you. Sometimes it comes to that, doesn't it? Are you ashamed? Are you ashamed of righteousness? Are you ashamed of goodness? Are you ashamed of the church? Are you ashamed of the gospel? Let's not be ashamed of Christ. How can I be ashamed of the one who died for my sins according to the Scriptures and was buried according to the Scriptures, rose the third day according to the Scriptures? Amazing. Amazing. So, popularity, fame, celebrity doesn't satisfy the human spirit. And how famous are you going to be in hell? Does fame have a value in hell? Does it? The devil's going to be in hell, according to Revelation. He's cast into the lake of fire. Is he going to have a value? Do you think anybody in hell is going to love the devil? Is going to rejoice in the devil and in sin? Number 7, right quickly. There are those that try to live their life this way. They think successful, purposeful, meaningful, joyful life is in education. They may not know anything about God. In fact, they may be opposed to God. But boy, they've been in school for years. They may spend all their lives in school as a student or as a teacher. And they just love. Remember Acts 17, the Athenians? They love to hear some new thing. Some new thing. Paul said to Timothy, there are some people that are always learning. There are also a lot of people that aren't learning much. They don't learn much at all. But there are some that are always learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. What's it for? What's all the learning for if you lose your soul? Even if by your learning you amassed an estate. You won a world. You won the respect of a continent by your learning, maybe by your wit. I tell you what, Voltaire was one of the wittiest men I've never ever read about. I mean, he's sharp. He's sharp. He was an influence in a bad way during the Renaissance period, but my goodness, what a mind he had. And he knew a lot of things. And I remember when I was in school, it was in college. I was already a full-time preacher, but I was taking some work. Arlington State University then, University of Texas at Arlington now. And we had to read this story, Candide. I'd never heard about Candide. Voltaire wrote that. And it's quite an adventure. And really, it's making fun of over-optimism in Christianity. Leibniz, you know, regardless of what happened, regardless of all the natural bad episodes like tornadoes or hurricanes or floods or whatever, drought, and regardless of the wars, you know, you just, somebody going through life just, oh well, it doesn't really matter. This is the best of all possible worlds. And he takes it like Leibniz is just sort of just laughing off these things that are so monumental in a person's life. And he writes this story to make fun of that kind of a thought. And it's funny. A little bit crude. It's very crude, but it's a little bit funny. But here's an educated man. We're still thinking about him and reading his stuff today. Poor Voltaire. He was no believer. Where is he now? And all of these people that spend their time in study and research and writing and thinking, and they've got a lot of capacity for it, but they're not honest and good enough to find God. And so their complete life is a misguidance. Regardless of their influence, their life is a misguidance. Education can't save you. I need some education. I need to learn how to read so I can read Scripture. That requires a little bit of education. I'm not killing education, throwing off. But you say, that's not the end of it. Education is for the pursuit of truth. Truth! Not just the pursuit without answers. Glenn and I have talked about, you know, teachers that sometimes they teach classes. They want to give you a lot of facts, but they don't even know what to do with them themselves. And they give you no help in trying to determine what this means. Oh, that's pitiful. I think a college student, just like a child in somebody's home, he needs guidance. He needs direction. He needs somebody giving him truthful answers to tough questions. The gospel does that. Education alone is not going to help. You go to hell as an educated fool. Number eight, there are those that try to stifle conscience. Because of their sins and their misery, they have to live at a level of blurred awareness. They don't want to be sensitive to their guilt and sensitive to their circumstances, and so they drown themselves in alcohol or drugs, trying to stifle their conscience and their mind, as it were, so that they won't feel bad. And the Bible says that's not the correct way to live at all. You're responsible. You're responsible for your drunkenness. You're responsible for your drugs. There are people that don't even look at that correctly, you know. Like, what did he do that for? Well, he was drunk. And they hold him to a lesser degree of responsibility because he got himself drunk. He's responsible for that, but people want to stifle themselves sometimes. Country songs are full of it, you know. Somebody at the bar drinking away his misery because his girl left him. And then the alcohol let him down. And so he has to complain about the drink. It wasn't getting the job done. Pitiful. What a world. What a world of ignorance and sin. An absolute misguide, isn't it? Psalm 20, verse 1, wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and he that erreth thereby is not wise. Now, I've explained before why it is that the Bible deals with drunkenness the way it does and does not just have an explicit remark, thou shalt not get drunk. I've explained the reason for that. Because of the time and the culture in which the revelation was being given and what was available to them in liquid form as a drink. And it's not 20th century beer, 21st century liquor. That's not what they had. But at any rate, it's said in a certain way to cover all circumstances. But people are fooled by it. And as Seth tells us, and it's true, almost everybody out there is drinking. And it's disgusting and it's sad because they don't seem to understand the danger that's involved and the heartache that it's already caused and the homes that it's already destroyed. It's just sort of a... You have to be a little bit careful with it, but it's all in all harmless. If you know, you take care of yourself and you be careful about it. We can be a Christian that drinks a little bit. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler. And if you err by this stuff, you're not a wise man. And we need to heed that, and young people need to be taught that. Debauchery. What other people do? Some people just saturate themselves in immoral filth. Pornography, living a fornicating life, adultery, and with drugs perhaps, just saturate my spirit in calamity, in corruption. Because there is a pleasure to sin, you know. Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season. The world, a lot of the world, love the pleasure of sin. And the more
more sin, the more pleasure. So let's just saturate ourselves. This is the way to live. It's like modern day Epicureanism, I guess you could say, in a sense. Debauchery. Debauchery. Romans 1, 18 through 32. Look at how the Gentiles lived when they gave up God. Debauchery. I guess we could say that. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 11, 9 through 11. The church at Corinth was composed partly of people that had lived a pretty immoral life, as Paul points out there. In Galatians 5, 19 to 21, the works of the flesh, they're pretty pitiful, and they're certainly ruinous. But until you get absolutely destroyed, you say you find an appeal to them. God has set the truth against error in the church by its purity and holiness and righteousness, shows the great distinction between God and the devil and truth and error and the righteousness and sin. We are to give clarity to the world in the lives that we live, as God gives us all clarity in the book that He gave. But some choose debauchery. And the final point is this. And a lot of people do this. They choose to deal with their sins and their spiritual problems by adopting a form of godliness that has no power. But it's enough to make them feel good about themselves. It's not obedience. It's not surrender to the gospel, the will of God. They want to be religious to a point. Some of them, maybe with regularity, attend services. Some of them don't do that necessarily. But they have concepts of God and God's love, and they think about heaven and loved ones that have passed away in days gone by. 2 Timothy 3:5, Paul referred to this very thing, that some have this form of godliness, but it doesn't have any power. It is devoid of influence, of good influence in their lives. So intellectually they can say, well, I'm a believer. I love the Lord. Now Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Then you're my friends if you do the things that I say. I love the Lord, but your religion is not what Jesus established. The church you're a member of, if you're a member of a church, is not the one He established. You may not even claim affiliation with a church as such. So they say they get religion with partial truth. Partial truth. Just enough to keep them happy and think they're not going to hell. And that's all they want. They don't want to grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ. They're not trying to bring God glory particularly in their lives. That's not what means the most to them. It's on the periphery. It's over here and it has its place. But here's something in my life that's first. But it's not that. It's a form of godliness. But it's not powerful. I want a form of godliness that's accurate, that is true, and that has complete effect. You remember in Acts 20, 27, we didn't get there this morning. Maybe we will next Sunday. Paul says, I'm pure from the blood of all men. How is that, Paul? Because I shrank not from declaring unto you the whole counsel of God. That's what he told the Ephesian elders. When I was in Ephesus, Acts 19, I preached the whole counsel of God. At least in summary fashion, I gave you all the truth, the principle whereby you could become a Christian and remain a faithful Christian. I didn't leave anything out. But if you don't know God, and if you don't really love God, but you're trying to satisfy yourself and deceive yourself into thinking that you do, I pick up a little bit of religion. Maybe I'll use the Lord's name occasionally and even thank Him. But I don't ever become a Christian. I don't ever learn the truth. Because, frankly, I was not that interested. And God knows the thousands and the thousands in America that are that way. Religious, to a degree. Know something about the Bible? A little bit. Do they study Scripture? No. Do they want to really delve and get into more knowledge of God and His will and eternity? No. They've got too many other things that they think needs to be done now. May God help us not to grow weary in our concepts and in our practice. May we hold on. Where could I go? Well, there are a lot of places people do go, trying to make something good out of this life. Where could I go? Where can you go? But to the Lord.